Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I'm recording on a Friday evening out in Reykjavik, Iceland, where we have a live volcano going off near Reykjavik now. If you listened to last week's show all the way to the end, you may have heard that I paused because there was a huge bang, which I left in the podcast, and it was an earthquake. We've been getting lots and lots of earthquakes. There is now a volcano. They've closed the site, but some people have been hiking up there. I might try and go if it keeps going long enough. I missed out last time, and I would love to see a live bubbling volcano spewing lava out of the earth. So that's what's been going on out here in Iceland. This week, I also finished Final Fantasy 16, finally. I felt like it was a bit of a long playthrough, longer than I expected. Around 30 hours, I thought, well, great, I'm nearly there. Turned out there was a lot more still to go. I was doing quite a lot of side quests and stuff, so it's a longer playthrough than I expected, but I finally got to the end of it. And when I did, I had such mixed feelings. Half of me was amazed by the experience, and half of me was like incredibly happy to be done with it and to see credits, because it had dragged on quite a bit. So I'm going to review that game today, finally, after promising it for the last couple of weeks. I finished the game. And I did, after I played it, a couple days on now, since I saw credits, I have found myself missing it in a strange way. It's funny to have a sense of relief to finish a big game, and to look forward to all of the things that you will play next, and then to just end up missing the game. And so I actually listened to some old reviews of Final Fantasy games, because I've missed out on everything since 7, basically. And I ended up actually buying Final Fantasy 13 for cheap on the Xbox storefront for like £11, because I was just very intrigued by it. I was intrigued by the look of it, the art style, the character, the lead female character, and this bright, vivid sci-fi world. And I thought, well, people say that was kind of a predecessor to the one that I just played. It's a little more turn-based. And so I'm going to dive in. I've played actually half an hour of it, and I quite enjoyed it so far. It's very corridory, and I can imagine that combat getting old, but I do fancy a little more Final Fantasy. I have still got Final Fantasy Remake Part 1 to finish also, so maybe I will go back to that. I also played a little bit more Zelda, and I have to say, every time I start up Tears of the Kingdom, I'm amazed by it all over again. This time, I was just wandering around as Link, finding Koroks, doing shrines, and I came to a beach, and there was a bottle there, and a crashed ship, and a message in a bottle telling me to follow the lights out to sea. So I built a little boat, a little raft, like a kind of catamaran design for the choppy water, and out I went into the sea, and before I knew it, I was being tossed by giant waves, fighting my way past Octoroks and Lizalfoss lizard people, and I have to say, it's such a good game, so perhaps Zelda will become my primary focus again, and I will actually get to the end of that game. I did also see a little bit of news just before I came on air. It was about the game Dave the Diver. There's been some rumblings about this on social media. I've certainly seen some people being transfixed by it. It seemed to have become something of a cult hit. Turns out it's more than a cult hit. It is a genuine hit. It has sold 1 million copies. This is the indie game where you play a diver who goes under the sea to catch fish and to collect resources, and then swims back up to the top, to the surface, where I believe you have to run a restaurant and cook the fish. So it's a cooking game and a resource game. Sounds a little bit like another game that I really liked, Battle Chef Brigade, another very underrated game. I think that probably sold a lot less than 1 million. So I've requested a code for Dave the Diver. I think the reason I hadn't played it is that it's Windows only, but then a Mac version seems to have dropped. So I've requested a code for that one. Have a look at it. If you're a Steam Deck player, maybe it could be a great game for the Steam Deck. It looks pretty interesting. If I get a code, I will talk about it. If I don't, I will wait for it to go on sale, and I will play it eventually. But I've been looking at my notes for Final Fantasy, and there are quite a lot of them. It looks like there are 4,500 words of notes here. That's quite a lot, even for me. So I'm going to keep this intro short. Just before we dive into that review, I would like to say a big thank you to the show's latest patron, Ruskar. Thank you very much to Ruskar for signing up for the $3 tier. Ruskar will get access to 10 bonus episodes and our wonderful little Discord server where people talk about games all the time, recommend games to each other, share our Wordle scores, our Coffee Golf scores. We're all still playing Coffee Golf. It's a great little game that I reviewed last week. If you haven't heard it, go and listen to it. It's a phone game. I recommend downloading Coffee Golf and paying that $2 just to throw the devs a couple clams for making it. It's a really lovely little game. So thanks very much to Roscar for becoming a patron. And if you would like to join them, come join our Discord and get the bonus episodes. You can do so at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. I will leave a link to that in the show notes. Thank you very much to all of my existing patrons. Thank you to Roscar for signing up. And thank you to you if you'd like to come and join the community and support this show. And with that said, let's get on with this review. It is time, finally, to talk about Final Fantasy XVI. So Final Fantasy XVI, it is the latest entry in the famed, much-loved, long-running Japanese role-playing game series. It is developed and published by Squeenix. It was made by Creative Business Unit 3, which is a hilarious name. They made Final Fantasy XIV, so it is the MMO team, which is quite interesting to note. It's a PlayStation exclusive currently, but I believe a PC version is in the works. I played it on PS5. It runs comparatively well to my eyes, I have to say, after playing the low-resolution Tears of the Kingdom and the framerate-troubled Jedi Survivor in the last couple of months. This game runs much better than either of those. The resolution was good. It has a couple stutters in complex areas, I will say, but for the most part, it ran incredibly well. I watched a Digital Foundry video about the technical side of this game that was fascinating, and they've done some really interesting work on it. Apparently, the resolution in this game drops when you go into combat as low as 720p to hit 60 frames a second, and I was amazed to find that out as someone who has played this whole game, because it looks so good in motion. I think 720p on a 4K screen sometimes to me looks unplayably jagged in old games like Bayonetta on Switch. But here I didn't even notice that the resolution was changing. I don't have a very trained eye in that Digital Foundry way, but to my eye, the game looked crisp and it ran well. The Metacritic score for this one is 88. It got a lot of 10 out of 10s. One of those 10s came from Hey Poor Player, who said it stands tall as a phenomenal example of contemporary video game craftsmanship. The lowest review that is on the summary page is from Digital Trends, who gave it a 6. They also praised the action, but said there is a general flatness surrounding the exhilarating highs, and they said that the shallow RPG elements and dated design speak to a series stuck in the past. There's interesting things in both of those. I think there is some grains of truth in both, so the high and the low. I have sympathy for both of the arguments, and I will be talking those through. How long to beat has this game at 33 hours for the story, 67 for completionists. My playthrough came in at 49 hours, having done most of the side quests, but not all of them by a long shot. That included about half of the monster hunts, which are kind of mini-boss plus battles. And I did most of the side quests, even though I wasn't particularly enjoying them, to try and stay ahead of the level curve. You know, if JRPGs have taught me anything, it's that you have to grind a little as you're playing the story, otherwise you might hit walls and just have to grind for a really disproportionate chunk of time to get past a boss. It did make the game feel a little too long for me. It stretched the story out, slowed the pace and momentum. But I did stay ahead of the XP curve. I think this is quite an easy game, so if you are playing it, I think that you could probably not do as much side stuff as I did and still have a good time. I would say skip the garden variety mini quests unless they specifically interest you, and only do the ones that are marked with a plus, because they give you rewards that are really worth having and that impact gameplay. And the studio describes the game by saying, "Enter the dark fantasy world of Valisthea in this highly anticipated single-player action RPG. The 16th standalone entry in the Final Fantasy series marks a darker turn, with complex tales of revenge, power struggles, and unavoidable tragedy." And I have to say of this one, It's a cinematic, dark fantasy action-adventure. Final Fantasy XV tells its epic story via lengthy cutscenes, light exploration, sleek battles, and stylish set pieces. Some excruciating quest design made the middle act drag, but the characters and the combat never got old. So there's a lot to say about this game. I've got a lot of notes here. And I think it's good to start this one with just a little summary about the game. So this is an interesting entry in the Final Fantasy series, and I will say my history with this is to have played the original Final Fantasy VII all the way to the end, way back in the PlayStation 1 era on 4 CDs. I dipped into Final Fantasy VIII and IX, but I didn't get very far into them. They didn't click with me in quite the same way. And since then, I've played most of the remake of VII, and I've played a little bit, like 2 or 3 hours, of Final Fantasy XV. So I've missed out on most of the modern 3D era. So I have a bit of a checkered history with Final Fantasy. I like it in theory. I've got some roots with, the intro that a lot of people had, which was Final Fantasy VII. And I'm always curious about it. I played the demo of this game, and I was blown away by it. I absolutely loved it. When I got to the end, I just immediately pre-ordered the game. I was really, really blown away by the demo. And it's interesting to play this one after the remake and after the history that I've had. I think it definitely seems like an acceleration of the trajectory set in the remake, away from party-based roots, away from those pixel art party-based, turn-based role-playing game roots, and towards a modern action-adventure. It's not an open-world game by any means, though. It's more wide linear, in the God of War style, with corridors and combat arenas and boss arenas, and small open areas that you can run around just a little. It's light exploration. They are wide linear in that God of War style. But I did find a couple of little optional bits along the way, the feeling of something catching your eye in the distance, like a tower, and going there just to see and finding a reward. It's a really nice feeling in terms of player agency. I think it's why I like open world games. And I think that this game could have maybe done a little more of that to make me feel connected to this world, as someone that lived there and was in it and grounded in the world, perhaps, rather than someone who was passing through a beautiful backdrop, kind of. This game is largely linear, and it's largely combat-focused, and the combat is a star of the show here. It does seem button-mashy at first, but there are lots of layers to it as the game progresses, and the moveset grows over time. This is largely due to the icon abilities, which are this game's version of summons. These are magic strikes derived from the powers of the summons, like Ifrit and all of that stuff. They're on cooldowns, and so you constantly have to be watching your cooldowns to see what powerful attacks you have at your disposal, and you cycle through them. That's like a nod to Final Fantasy's turn-based roots, I think. There is still a feeling of waiting to use your abilities at the right time, which connects them somewhat. And I'm playing Final Fantasy XIII for just a couple of hours, or even less. It was interesting to see the live-action turn-based approach that they had there, so the action keeps happening and it gives you that kinetic feeling. This takes that even further. The summons really light up the screen. They are really a joy to use. And I was surprised that as I got more icons in my repertoire and the moveset deepened, more strategies opened up to me. It would have been very easy to go through this game just using the first few abilities, and you could do that. It's tempting almost when you get new icons to try them out and then go back to the old familiar style. But the range that was available definitely surprised me. My playstyle evolved in the late game based on the new icon abilities that were available to me. So I do recommend if you do play this game to experiment and not get stuck in your ways, because it will keep the combat fresh, and the scale to which some of those attacks grow might surprise you. The combat peaks in the cinematic set piece clashes. These are absolutely huge. There are two in the demo where you just become the summon. So you become Ifrit or you become Shiva, etc. And it's a different kind of combat then. You have less moves and it's more like a screen spectacle where you're bashing each other, knocking down mountains, shooting up into the air, fighting against other kaiju. It's a cool little sub-game. Reminds me a lot of Bayonetta. We'll come back to that. It's fire and brimstone. It gets the blood pumping every time. Another pillar of the game is the cutscenes. So you have your traversal, you have your combat, you have your spectacles, and then you also have these voice-acted cutscenes, which happen a lot. You're going to have to be someone that is comfortable with sitting down watching a cutscene to enjoy this game. But I will say that the quality of them is second to none. They have a cinematic aspect that feels like you're watching something that was filmed, that has tangible cinematography. The direction is excellent. It pulls focus. There's all kinds of nuanced facial expressions, really interesting camera work that you might not expect. Some of it very memorable, and I will go into that more. There is a lesser quality cutscene as well. Like the story ones are very impressive. There is a second tier where you're just talking to people, NPCs, villagers, etc. You might get into some cutscenes there that are a little more stiff-bodied and a little more awkwardly lip-synced. But overall, I enjoyed the cutscene vibe of this game. It did surprise me. I did feel like it was a bit of a HBO meets video game crossover to a degree, even more than the major Sony games. So it's an interesting aspect of the game. The thing that I mentioned in my little summary at the very beginning is the side quests. You will also spend a lot of time side questing in this game. There are scores and scores of nothingy side quests that gate power-ups, equipment, companion backstories, and lore. They're optional. There are some side questy things shoehorned into the main story, so you can't avoid them completely. But they are there. It's a thing, for me especially. I think some people really enjoy lore and they really enjoy companion backstories. I got a little sick of it. I think the writing quality didn't quite grab me enough to engage me in those quests in a meaningful way, partially because you just do three things. You either fetch something, talk to someone, or kill some monsters. That's basically your lot. They are remixed and put together. You might have to talk and then kill, kill and then fetch, that kind of thing. It depends how interested you are in the backstory of this world and filling that out with all the minutiae of the people that you meet and the countries that you go through and the different regions. I was just banking XP and moving on. It may sound like heresy to Final Fantasy fans, but I would say aside from the excellent main story, the side quests felt underwritten and did not hold my interest at all. And I think that my ultimate conclusion at the end of this review might include something like this playtime extending fluff stuff, watering down the game considerably, because there is a distilled excellence in this game, in the production values, in the writing, the characters, the combat, the spectacle, the landscape. But when it's watered down as thoroughly by doing repetitive tasks as this game does, it was a little much for me. But it did not stop the game from being good. There's a lot to love about this game. And I will say that the scenario of the game, to move on to the meat of things, the game throws a lot of jargon at you pretty thick and fast. It's a high fantasy world. I'm going to do my best to boil it down here. So the game is set in the high fantasy world of Valisthea, where there are various houses at war, noble houses. Magic users have been enslaved in this world. They are known as bearers, except for the dominant. And these are the most powerful magic users. They can transform into icons, aka the Final Fantasy summons that we all know and love. Titan, Odin, Ifrit, Shiva, etc. And these dominants are venerated. They are lords. It's a bit weird that the rest of the magic users are slaves in this game. Wizards aren't usually slaves. They're usually considered to be special. If someone could start fire with their hands, I think I would definitely think that they were special and that they might have power and be worthy of interest and respect. But in this game, they are slaves. That's part of the narrative. Bit weird, but okay. And the game begins with a prelude in Valisthea. It's the demo, basically. And it's a long flashback sequence that establishes the characters, the houses, the world, and the inciting events of the main story. I would say it's a high point in the game. It's a flawless demo. It's just brilliant. It made me buy it. I was mind blown by it, and I bought the game immediately. Some of the mid and late game spectacles are comparable, but the demo, or rather the prelude, hits such heights in terms of spectacle and combines it with a very tight storytelling. It's drama. It's Game of Thrones. You're glued to it. And the middle and end of the game, I think, perhaps struggled to live up to that level of polish and tight, taut storytelling. But in this game, we play as Clive Rosfield. In that prelude, we're playing as Clive as a teenager. He is the firstborn son of the noble house of Rosaria. He is a spiky-haired Final Fantasy J-pop Jon Snow. The voice actor is called Ben Starr, and he does an amazing job. He did really well with some quite uneven writing, and I really feel that he imbued Clive with a believability and character that carried the game along. It's a very believable protagonist. He has a lot of personality. I think a lot of that comes down to great facial animation, which does look a little like Ben Starr, and this wonderful voice acting. And while Clive might be the firstborn son of the Rosfields, he is not the foremost son, because he is not a dominant. He doesn't have the power of fire in him. And so he is not the mega weapon of this household. He is not the power of the household, much to the disappointment of his mean mom. And that means he can't summon. Instead, he is made a bearer, just a lesser magic user in the eyes of the world. So he's highborn, but he's low caste. And what this means in terms of his value and place in the world is an ongoing theme, like Clive's identity, who he is, who he is meant to be, and who he wants to be. And the dominant of the House of Rosaria and the Rosfields is Joshua, his younger brother, who was a little sickly child. He was the dominant of Phoenix. This means he can transform into a giant rampaging Phoenix, and he has special power. He is considered the kind of nuclear deterrent and nuclear option of his house. He's smart, but he is pale and shy. He's a big contrast in personality to the more robust, rugged Clive. Joshua is voiced by the kid who did Hugo in Plague Tale, interestingly. He also does a very good job. And Clive is assigned to be Joshua's shield, aka his bodyguard. He also acts as a kind of role model to his younger brother. And I don't want to spoil too much of it. That's the essentials of the game. But there are some unfortunate events that take place in that intro. It has a dramatic finale, and it leads to Clive being out in the world on his own. I've skipped over a big chunk there, because I don't want to spoil it for anyone. And after that, we flash forward into the future. Clive is all grown up, and he is on the run. And he stumbles into an enclave of outlaws, waifs, and strays. And after that action-packed, story-dense prelude, that's when the story really begins. In this modern world, with an older Clive, whose house is gone, who is out in the world, has become an outlaw, we learn about the state of this world and what has happened in the meantime. And Valisthea is subject to a creeping blight that sucks the life out of nature. It's like a disease of the land. It creates ashen dead zones, causing famine, forced immigration, tensions between the various houses, resource wars. All of that might sound a little familiar. It is somewhat of an environmental parable, which I was happy to see in the game. The same is true of Final Fantasy VII, of course, in which you're basically a kind of environmental terrorist group. So those sub-themes of nature and industry, the magical energy of nature, and humanity's relation to that, respecting the Earth, that is present here again. It is, once again, it's more of a story motif than anything else, but I like it anyway. The game has other themes. Slavery is here, and the caste system. Free will and destiny are here. And they're explored with varying degrees of clarity. I would say that is thematically interesting, but also a little mushy somehow in where it takes these different themes that it has established. But more on that later. Back to Clive's story. This game really is Clive's story. He will grapple with his past. He will grapple with those events that you played through in the prelude. He will try and untangle the truth of what happened back then and what is happening to the world now, and he will try and set things right. This includes questing around the game world, which is a series of different areas accessed from the map. There are different friendships, crises, romances. His outlaw friends are quite a colourful bunch. Clive will be growing his powers. He'll be battling dominance of other houses. He will be investigating the cause of the blight. And in the end, of course, as it is a Final Fantasy game, he's going to end up trying to save the world. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. And as well as enemy dominance and the various icons like Odin and Bahamut and all of those things that we know from previous Final Fantasy games, the game also has a villain, and it's a pretty cool villain called Ultima. He's kind of a mix between Dr. Manhattan, Goro from Mortal Kombat and the Borg, like the Borg Queen from Star Trek First Contact. I really liked Ultima. I loved it when they're on the screen. They have this dead-eyed, creepy, calm-voiced menace, and they will pop up and taunt and probe Clive, and finding out who they are and what they want is a big part of the story. They will occasionally give TED Talks about destiny and free will that you have to kind of sit through, but Ultima was a very effective villain, I would say. And something that struck me and has been going around a lot on social media, has struck a lot of people, is the elephant in the room, really, which is that this Final Fantasy game is heavily influenced by some fantasy universes that are well-known, well-loved. The most popular fantasy universes ever are very, very present in this game. I think this game kind of shamelessly and joyfully plucks and pulls from other fantasy universes. So I'm going to run through some of this game's many influences. I think Lord of the Rings is the first one that sprang to mind, and the game opens with a kind of a reenactment of the Gandalf versus the Balrog battle, a falling fight where they emerge into a huge cavern. You know that famous shot in Lord of the Rings where they emerge into the cavern, they're falling, you see a streak of flame falling vertically towards water. They just do that, basically. They just lift that shot. It's like a little cover version and a tribute to that moment. But a lot of the locations brought Lord of the Rings to my mind. For example, Orthanc, Saruman's White Tower, like a scratch on the sky. That is very present here. The White City of Minas Tirith, the architecture, the long bridges, the giant statues, the named swords, and the history of it all, the historicity of it all, is very present here and taken from Lord of the Rings. The general look of this world reminded me of John Howe's paintings of Middle-earth that were used as concept art for the Peter Jackson films. There is definitely a lot of love for Lord of the Rings in this game. The other one, the biggest one probably, is Game of Thrones. You've probably heard this, and it can't be overstated. It starts with Clive. He is just Jon Snow, basically, but hotter. He's like Jon Snow gone J-pop with spiky hair. If his leather armor was designed by like Victoria's Secret, he has quite a daring, plunging neckline and a corseted bodice, you could say. So Clive is very J-pop Jon Snow. And other characters from Game of Thrones they're pretty much just here. His unit captain in The Prelude is clearly modeled after Jaime Lannister. He is facially similar to him. Joshua, his younger brother, is a spooky kid with a wolf pet, pretty much Bran Stark from Game of Thrones. There is a Hodor-style guy. One of the antagonists is basically the Mountain. There is a Cersei Lannister-type character. Not just the characters and the fashion and all of that stuff, but there is also a sense that everyone is expendable, that I relate to Game of Thrones. You know, characters die. There is a lot of violence, bloody violence, sex, death, swearing. There is a lot of effing and blinding, as my mum would say, in this game. And it's a Eurocentric, magical, medieval kind of world. Very Game of Thrones, very grim in that same way as the North. All of the characters are voiced by regional British accents that give it that earthy kind of feel that relates to both Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings, I would say. And I found these influences to be interesting. I don't say them as a bad thing. They were kind of welcome, but they were also kind of funny in how earnestly and accurately the influences were quoted. I mean, we don't really think about Game of Thrones now, but I kind of felt like the game was like a time capsule of Game of Thrones hype, because that game was omnipresent, you know, at the peak when we were all glued to every episode, getting the popcorn, getting the big screen going, at least I was, to see what would happen with the White Walkers and the Starks and all of that stuff. The game's development must have started around that time. So it's a funny little time capsule to open it and feel that Game of Thrones excitement that is long since gone. But it does give the game some grit and texture, this medieval miserabilism. It's very different to the bright and breezy futurism of Final Fantasy 13 and to the kind of the modern machiney magic and industry of Final Fantasy 7. But it's not always good. I would say that the game's map is like a facsimile of that model realm that we see in the famous Game of Thrones opening credit sequence. It looks good. It's got that bronze burnished look to it, but it doesn't work to explain this world. So they've used that Game of Thrones visual style, but it doesn't work here. It's an interesting topography that you find yourself roaming across. You know, there are deserts, there are different biomes, there are these ashen places. And I think a little more color and a little more topography on that map and some more distinctive features would make the world, you know, like the overworld in a traditional JRPG. You walk around, you get a sense of scale and grandeur and the big journey that you're on. That's not really present in this bronze static map. And so it felt more like a level select screen to me, which is a bit of a shame because the map is really where you're choosing where to go next. You're looking at the world. And the fact that it didn't really represent the breadth and color and palette and topography of the environments that you're walking through left me with a sense of discombobulated confusion about the larger world that I was inhabiting. It made the different biomes that you go to just feel like levels that you were clicking on rather than part of this large world. And believing in Valisthea more, I think, could have been achieved if they had done the map a little differently and strayed from that Game of Thrones influence in this case. And that is a shame because the art style of the game is wonderful. I absolutely love the look of it. I love what they have achieved in terms of the environments that you come through. It's really wonderfully bleached out. It has this drab color palette, a bit like Fumito Ueda's games, like Shadow of the Colossus, Last Guardian. There is a lot of pale stone and muted nature, panoramic views that look more like oil paintings than computer game graphics. There are improbably long stone bridges, castles lining the horizon. It's like walking through a giant fantasy painting. It's often eye-catching. Some of the vistas are just breathtaking. That said, it can feel like a backdrop more than a present, vibrant world to explore, partially due to the linearity of it all. I did hunger sometimes to stretch my legs a little more and to feel like I was forging my own path rather than passing through these curated spaces. I felt a little kept on the leash by the format of the game. But the worlds do look beautiful, and I'm not saying that open world games are better, but I do think that this game may have been better with a little more open world influence. I do think of God of War. I think that God of War's hub area, where there's a lake that you can row around, or a frozen lake that you can take your huskies over, that felt like a fairly big area. I did feel let off the leash in that area, even if it was just the illusion of freedom, because what you're really doing is just traveling between these little mini dungeons and little enemy bases that you can take down and stuff to get treasure. That's not really present here. So even the illusion of freedom is very toned down here. You do know where you're going all the time. You're going from pin to pin and place to place. And it felt more railsy as a result. And I personally like to feel freedom. I like to really feel like I'm in the world. And that railsy feeling detracted from that for me, just a touch. But I would like to shout out the architecture of the game too. The architecture is wonderful. You'll see a lot of it as you're wandering around. You'll see those viaducts and aqueducts in the distance. You'll come to villages with houses with sagging, huge tiled roofs and raftered buildings and hovels. You will move through raftered banquet halls and throne rooms, the giant stone bridges and gateways. It's all very beautiful to look at, the medieval part of it all. But the landscape is also peppered with these mysterious fallen structures. Imagine the stone chunks from Tears of the Kingdom, but much bigger, part of something bigger. From the outside, they look like these huge, skinny, white stone structures that have fallen from on high and driven into the landscape like a javelin. They are very, very striking. You do get to go inside some of them. They're in different stages of decomposition. They've clearly been there for a long time. And inside, they're kind of alien-feeling spaces. They're very slender and graceful, long walkways, like elven structures from Lord of the Rings, but space age. There's tech in there. They have strange machinery. They have doors that light up and open, ornate mechanical stuff. Some of them are said to be crashed airships. Others look more like chunks of some fallen airborne city. Very, very, very cool. And these fragments scatter across the map. Their origin seems to be forgotten in the lore of this game, although you will meet someone in a side quest who will be doing a bit of archaeology. I enjoyed that side quest. It's one of the few that I really enjoyed. The outlaws use them for shelter, and they build human structures inside of them. So you'll find wooden staircases and scaffolds built up inside these alien stone structures. It's very, very cool. The outlaw hub that you will be going back to a lot is a very impressive space. The white stone is scored and semi-ruined. There's a lot to look at in there and to wonder about. I like the sense of wondering what it was all about. They hint at this bigger forgotten story, this forgotten history of this world. Where did this ancient tech come from? It's so different to the mud and steel of life in this medieval world. But it all does add up to Valis Thea having this otherworldly feel, which I quite enjoyed. It is both coherent and familiar in the medieval fantasy of it all, but also quite discombobulating in the grandiosity and strangeness of these white stone structures. And the wilderness itself is beautiful too. I think not being open world does allow for a more handmade set of areas to walk through. They are densely detailed. It's wonderful when you walk through the dark woods or the steppes or the fields of the countryside. They all feel very handcrafted rather than procedurally generated. The woods are just so dark and lush, and the swamplands are packed with vegetation, nooks to go and look into, cradled by spectacular mountains on all sides. There are vast waterfalls, huge craters. There's a white salt desert with bright geothermal pools, and of course those blighted areas that you'll pass through too. There's just a sense of epic scale in all of the architecture and the wilderness and landscapes of this game. And I think that this is all aided by the cinematic nature of the cutscenes. There are a lot of cutscenes in this game. Anytime you talk to someone, you will often be snapped into one. And there are long, minutes-long cutscenes where story unfolds, where conversations take place. You don't get to make many choices. I think there were like 3 A-B choices throughout the game. So you're just observing, really. But I think that this game is as heavily influenced by film as games like The Last of Us, which is probably the other most cinematic AAA game I've played. And a lot of this is in the film techniques that I was quite surprised to see, like establishing shots that linger from overhead over a location before you cut into the campfire where the conversation is happening. It gave the landscape room to breathe. And then when you're in conversation, the camera will pull focus, change depth of field mid-shot, as if shot on film. Sometimes it looked like a Steadicam camera, other times it was shaky and handheld, like you're following someone as they walk. There were slow pans and detailed zoom-ins, close-ups. The use of landscape was really cool, sometimes as a spectacular background. But I really enjoyed those shots that just lingered over the nature, like a several second shot of a waterfall before you go into a conversation on the bridge, as if to indicate time passing. It's present in all of the interior cutscenes too. There is a really unusual use of background and foreground that I really enjoyed, a little bit like Cyberpunk 2077, where the camera will focus on an object and then pull focus and focus on a face that is you're looking at from below, from table height. I really enjoyed a shot of the Emperor's Council when you're looking at the council arguing, and suddenly the Emperor's hand raises into the shot, and we realize that we're looking from his exact eye perspective. You're looking at the back of his hand, and it swings into focus. It was startling, really cinematic, really well done. Your friend Sid, who you will meet at the start of the game, seeing him shot from table height, his hand comes down right into the camera. So his hand is right in your face, and he puts out a cigarette. This is really refined stuff. It has a director's sensibility in a way that I really enjoyed. As for what you're actually doing when you're traveling through this beautiful, textured world and this interesting story, the gameplay consists mostly of traversal, combat, and quests. There is not that much exploration and freewheeling, so you're just going through your tasks, basically. There are 3 types of quests. There are story quests that are red, there are side quests that are green, and then there are upgrade quests, which have a little plus symbol. In the base, you will get these from the main characters. They will ask you for favors, or they will give you story-relevant tasks. There is always a way forward in the main quest. You'll also get them from nobodies. You might get them from just randoms who are standing around, might ask you for something. And as the outlaw kind of champion, in a way, as the Robin Hood of the piece, I felt obligated to do them. You will also get field quests, usually from someone whose car is broken down, might ask you to get rid of the monsters up ahead or to find their waylaid friends, which usually means killing some bandits or monsters. You also have a missives table in your chambers where you can read letters from the other characters, even if they are just standing a few feet away, which is a little funny. But you can read those letters, and it might be someone is concerned about the blacksmith who seems sad lately. You can then go and talk to the blacksmith, figure out what is wrong with them, maybe get them some materials and end up with a better sword, that kind of thing. The missives table gave some of the best quests, I think. They were the most personal, and they belonged to named characters that are somewhat central to the story. Afterwards, you get a little letter that you can read about the outcome of the quest. It's a cute touch. There are those three types that I talked about. There are the talky quests, so you go and talk to someone, try and resolve a situation. Usually just a lot of cutscenes. There are fetch quests, many fetch quests, including the infamous fetch quest that I've seen mentioned on social media a lot, where you're asked to go and get 5 handfuls of soil from the bank of a river, and that is what you do. That quest actually recurs. Later you have to go and get some silt. Same thing. Go to a place, get 5 handfuls of dirt, walk home again. Then there are the kill quests and the combat quests where you're killing monsters. Those are fun because the combat is so great. There are also hunts. There is a hunt board, although it's not exactly Monster Hunter. It is mostly tougher versions of bosses you've seen before. The rewards that you get are XP for leveling up. You get ability points that allow you to unlock new icon abilities. There is also a currency to buy stuff with, although the economy of the game is almost pointless. It's just a showpiece, really. I was constantly getting wireite metal and steel silk. I think by the end I had 700 of each. Maybe I was supposed to be using them or selling them, but the fact that I didn't even feel the need to know what they were, really, and just ended up with mountains of the stuff tells you that the economy is just for show, really. You also get some renown for doing quests for the people. That allows you to unlock these gifts from the people. It's a very Robin Hoodie vibe with that. But the plus quests are the really good ones. That's when you get really good weapons, really good upgrades. Sometimes you get items for this kind of memory shrine for doing character quests or favor quests. So you get these keepsakes that you can look at throughout the game. I felt like I was supposed to care more about those. I think there's about 20 of them. I ended up with about 15, but I really didn't remember what a lot of them were. It was like the sign from a pub where I apparently did a lot of good or whatever. I think I was meant to care about them more. So the quests are, I would say, the weak point of this game. The side quests are terrible. They're some of the worst side quests I've played. The writing is not good. And the activities that you're doing are incredibly repetitive. I did them anyway, just for the XP. The combat is always fun, so I was relieved when it was like, go and kill a giant troll, because fighting the giant troll is fun. So the combat ones were my favourite. And that's because the combat in this game just rules, basically. It's a little influenced by, I would say, Bayonetta, a game that I've played and enjoyed. People say Devil May Cry. I've only dipped very briefly into that game. But it's basically fast dodge strike combat. Enemies come at you. You have a perfect precision dodge that will slow down time so you can strike back. There are lots of mobs around you. They are indicated very clearly by red arrows all around you. So I always felt in control in the field. They are combat arenas, so there will be an edge that appears. You will only be able to fight in a small area. But I felt like it was executed very well. And Clive is just a monster in combat. It's like holding a tiger by the tail, watching him fight, or fighting as him. You do have a basic combo attack, like a slash combo. You can upgrade your sword. You have a weak ranged attack, which is like throwing little fireballs. I barely used it, except when an enemy was perhaps airborne and far away, or a boss that was temporarily out of range. You have that dodge, a precision dodge, if you get it just right. You can jump, and you can do a jump attack. You can grapple enemies that are airborne and flash to them. There is an ability that lets you jump between enemies in a really cool way. So you're always moving, you're always hitting, you're always dodging. And you do unlock more basic abilities like charge attacks, upward and downward strikes, air juggles, and etc. But the combat is really all about the icon abilities. The basic combat is fine, but the icon abilities are where the juice is. The icons are the summons that we know and love, Odin, Titan, Garuda, Shiva, Ifrit, all of those summons that we know from past Final Fantasy games. And as you become empowered by them, they each give you new magic attacks that go onto a cooldown. Each one has an intrinsic ability if you have it equipped. For example, Titan gives you an earth block, so you can lift up the earth and hold it in front of you. Garuda gives you a grapple, so you can move very quickly, Garuda being the icon of wind. And so those are all different. You get one of those built into your basic repertoire when you equip the icon. Each one also has four special attacks that you can power up with your ability points to an ultimate version, which is like a powered-up version, often which includes more animation, like an extra phase of that magic attack that just makes them massive. And they're all on cooldowns. Some are very quick. For example, there is a fire move that I use throughout the game that will clear a mob from around you. You just spin around with your phoenix wings. You'll have these flaming wings that appear, and it will knock back all of the enemies. That was a very cool crowd control move that never stopped being useful. Others are devastatingly powerful, but they recharge really, really slowly. So, for example, a giant lightning strike, if you have that powered up to the maximum, it will destroy the screen, basically. It's so cool. But it will take minutes to charge up again when you have to be using your base attacks or using your quick icon attacks. You do only have three icon slots, so you have to pick and choose which icons you're going to use. But you can mix and match the abilities from each of those three. And it does start to offer, I would say, a wealth of options in how you personalize your combat that became more apparent as the game wore on. I stopped being quite so button mashy. I think as the enemies became a little more dangerous, because they are not for the first half of the game. I think I didn't die until hour 25 or something. But towards the end of the game, I definitely was picking and choosing my icon slots and my abilities so that I would always have something on the go. You're kind of judging how long the cooldowns are. If you have all heavy abilities, you're going to be stuck for long periods with no available icons whilst they're all on cooldown. So you have to mix and match and find the ones that you like. And I really enjoyed that about the game. You do start with the Phoenix. That's your base one. I guess that's the icon ability of the house that you belong to, of the Rosfields. And I think I clung on a little too long to the Familiar. I guess they are the first ones you get. They are base useful in combat. Some of the others are more complex. There is one late game ability that I got, a late game icon, where you get a sword that operates in a really interesting way. It took me a while to understand it. I'm not going to spoil which icon it belongs to or anything, but it's an attack called Zentutsuken. You get this long sword, and it seems very weak. It's very, very fast, and you can hit an awful lot. And it took me a while to really get it, because every time you land these weak hits, what you're doing is charging up a mega attack. So you have to kind of hold your own for a while with these weak flurries of attacks that do look quite cool, and it is a big, long sword. But then you get like a, when you're at fully charged at Zentutsuken level 3, you can hold down square and execute this like samurai-style execution move, like in Ghost of Tsushima, that is just incredible to look at. And the more powered up it gets, the more ridiculous and the more powerful and the more damaging it is. And that added a whole new layer of strategy to the game. So when I started using Zentutsuken alongside Phoenix and Ramu, the lightning attacks that I talked about that immobilize enemies while hitting them with lightning bolts, I had a build that I was really happy with that allowed me to move quickly and always have something that was coming out of cooldown. So I absolutely loved the combat in this game. It never got old. It was just spectacular to look at. Particles everywhere, fire and lightning flying, just mashing hordes of enemies. There are some really big enemies that charge at you in different ways. The boss fights are very, very cool. Even the base boss fights are big in scale, but the actual boss fights where you're facing off against other icons and dominants are just incredible. So the combat really kept the momentum going in this game. And I really did like the story, honestly. I liked Clive's story. The characters felt well done. They felt believable. And I was really interested in Joshua, Clive's brother. I was really interested in Sid, the outlaw leader who you encounter in your journey. There were some really memorable villains. My favorite was called Benedicta Harmon, and she climaxed in this incredible boss battle against like a marionette type icon figure. But there are heavy themes in the game. As I said at the start, there is a theme of slavery, of the magic users, the bearers being slaves. The bearers are property, and you will encounter that throughout the game. And I have to admit, like, I got a little done with the thematic content and side quests of this game by about halfway through. Like, I didn't feel like it was really going anywhere. Like, we all know slavery was very bad, and human bondage is very bad. And that seemed to be about the sum of what this game was saying about slavery as a theme. So I ended up speeding through a lot of dialogue, and I'm not entirely sure how that theme resolved ultimately. I don't have a detailed take for you on that. If you have played this game and you think I missed out because Final Fantasy 16 has an incisive take by the end of the game, feel free to correct me at me on social media. I would like to hear about it, but I tuned out of the thematic content a little bit. The other major theme in the story, I think, seems to be that individuality is important. The enemy figure, Ultima, he's one of these baddies who wants to take the whole world under his spell kind of thing. It's like the Star Trek Borg or the Guardian of the Galaxy sort of mystical hypnotic promise of something else of transcendence, or a little bit like Sauron's allure in Lord of the Rings, how he wins people over with promises of power and transcendence and all of that stuff. Sometimes I think, like, this recurring theme in games, sometimes it seems to be like a post-war allegory, you know, like the rebellion versus the evil empire. It's like a World War II thing, the way that we see British pilots and American troops against the nasty old Nazis and all that stuff, and that's fine. Like, obviously, totalitarianism is also bad. I don't feel like the game goes very deep on the themes. They are placeholdery. So it's a good job that the characters are good, you know what I mean? Because, like, in the face of totalitarianism, like, rugged individualism and taking down the bad guys rocks and is fine. And obviously it's bad to lose oneself to a horrible ideology. And I guess that does have some resonance in the current times that we are in. And it's bad to be influenced to the point of being polluted or submerged or perverted in some way, and to have your better judgment washed away. I guess that's present in the Borg. I guess that's present in Guardians of the Galaxy. I guess that's present here. But there is a question that comes to my mind, and I was writing my notes before doing this podcast, whilst I was cooking dinner, after I'd written all my notes and just thinking about what I was going to say, I watched a video by Kyle Bosman, a content creator that I really like. It's on this theme, surprisingly. We were talking in different ways about the same thing. His thesis was that these games are about the special boy. He talked about, I guess, Luke Skywalker and all of the games in which you are a hero who starts out humble or normal and goes on to become a world-saving hero figure, power fantasy individual that saves the world. It's a really interesting video. It's funny. Kyle's a really funny games commentator. I will leave a link to that in the description. My take is slightly different. There is a power fantasy of outsized individual heroism in these games for sure, or a scrappy band of rebels who rely on each other. The plucky hero always hits play on their Walkman or finishes their cigarette or, you know, does a pose with a sword before raising their eyebrow, thinking of their loved ones, and then wiping out all the baddies. And I get what I'm supposed to take from this, you know? I get that I'm supposed to take the heroism and the good guy feeling from it, but I sometimes don't. It feels a little simplistic to me in some way, and a little tired to me in some way, just the power fantasy and the idea that I am supposed to be feeling so good about being Clive Rosfield, rather, the world-straddling kind of superpower who's going to save us from everything. There's something about the individualism of it all that troubles me just a touch, because I wonder about other portrayals of collective will. You know, I'm a big old socialist myself. I believe in society. I believe in collective will, collective good, compassion, consensus building, all of that stuff. Even in these difficult times, I still have that flame flickering. And sometimes when I see this rugged individualism of this hero against the evil empire, which is all about forced consensus, I'm hungry for another kind of narrative, I think. Like, I think something about this game, it's interesting to contrast what I'm saying with what Kyle Bosman said, so do go and watch that video. But this game pushed that to an extreme, where Clive was almost too perfect or too noble or believed in himself so much and believed that his power was everything, something about it struck me the wrong way. I don't have a tidy, clean point to tie up all of this rambling that I've just done and to tie up this line of thinking, but it is something that I wanted to express. I think there is a philosophical question attached to this power fantasy hero story. And these narratives can feel sometimes a little hollow. And whilst all of the characters in Final Fantasy 16 are above average, some of them are actually very good. I did like Clive. I loved Joshua. Jill was cool. Sid was amazing. There's a character called Gav, who I have to mention. He's a Geordie guy. He's very, very funny. He's a good character. The characters were good. But something about the narrative of the hero's journey felt a little hollow. And that just got me thinking. I guess a lot of games are like this. Most games have this in them somewhere. And it did make me yearn for another more subtle kind of story. But to round up some of the good things and bad things about this game, the good, the cinematic style, it's more filmic than almost any other game I can think of. It is as close to HBO meets video game as anything that I've seen, with the focusing, the close-ups, the wide shots. The cutscenes are excellent. It's like a playable Netflix show, and I was here for that. The world design and the production values are off the charts. The towers, vistas, craters, it's captivating to look at. Even if it did sometimes feel like more of a painted backdrop than a varied world to go into and explore, it's still a AAA-ass video game and succeeds as such. Voice acting is stellar, some of the best that I've ever heard. I loved that they used regional British actors. They've assembled a really good cast here. They delivered some very difficult lines and a lot of RPG cliches in a very cool way. So I think that they really brought the script to life in a way that I've not really heard. It felt more grounded for that reason. I think it was the accents and the actors that really grounded this world. It suggests a large kingdom, you know, with regions, and I loved hearing those accents as a British person. I liked the low-key environmentalism, like in Final Fantasy VII. Although I wish it was a little more nuanced, a little more deep, taken a little further. The combat was wonderful. It never got old. It's kinetic. It's sleek. You feel massively powerful in combat. You get to split the screen open with your icon abilities. I love the slow-mo that you get on the last hit of the match, of the battle, rather, which is sometimes your most powerful ability. So if you're splitting the screen with lightning, and then you get the slow-mo spin of the enemy as they die, it's very, very cool. I like the variety in the icon abilities and the strategies they opened up to me. Overall, I think the story is good, even if I'm questioning the thematic content and how deep or well-realized it is. Ultimately, the story still worked for me. It's a good character-led story, even if the themes didn't amount to an awful lot to me. As for the bad stuff, the side quests almost tank the game. They are short, basic, shallow, and endless. The 2 to 5 minute fetch quests for XP, the handfuls of mud quests, the collect a lettuce for me quests, that stuff should not be in the game. It's just really bad, to be frank. I would say that the map's featurelessness and blandness didn't give me a sense of the world, as I described earlier. I would have liked a more topographical map to give me a sense of place. It's a case of style over substance. And that's another question, you know, the influences of the game. I was here for it. I think others won't be. I think that, ironically, past Final Fantasy feels like a lesser influence to me because of that. It's more of a Game of Thrones game. It took the sight of a chocobo for me to locate this game within the lineage of Final Fantasy a little bit. And the one Moogle that you meet looks like he's wandered into the wrong game, because it's also gritty and grimy and vast. Seeing chocobos and Moogles, I was like, oh yeah, it's Final Fantasy. So I think some Final Fantasy fans may feel that the lineage is sort of tokenistic in a way, but I didn't mind it so much. I will say that this willing mashup of familiar elements does result in a kind of a layered hybrid world that I was kind of into. I think the upgrade system and the RPG elements are perfunctory in this game. It's like they have to be there. They are obligatory feeling. They are a nod to the past of the series, but they don't really have to be there. It could have been trimmed down. It's interesting in that way, right? Because they are trying to make it a Final Fantasy game. And so it has lots of the trappings of that. If they had gone too far into Devil May Cry, God of War, then maybe that would have felt like stretching too much or really getting away from the roots. But in some way, going all the way would have been better, like just cut away the chaff, you know. But I can see why this game ends up feeling like a compromise between the old and the new, rather than perhaps the big, bold step, if you know what I mean. There are dungeons in the game, but they are just series of combat rooms, really. It's no puzzling, no exploration. They felt immediately routine. There are a handful of them. They're just combat gauntlets. So if you're expecting dungeons, they won't be here. And the game is very easy. I'm not against that. It's not really a criticism from me. But the base difficulty I breezed through, I think I died less than 10 times. I'm not against that. I like it. I like being propelled through the story. But I think it's worth flagging that some people might be disappointed by it. I will say that because of those side quests, the middle section of the game felt endless. It didn't live up to the quality of the promise of that demo, which is so tight and focused. And given the game's cinematic leanings, I would say the final edit of this game could do with maybe losing half the stuff to make the game tighter, which might sound brutal and against the spirit of JRPGs, but I think I would have liked this game twice as much if it were half as long. So it's a good game in conclusion, but it does have an Achilles heel in the quest design. But it got so much right. The story, the setting, the amazing VO, the facial animation, the art and landscape, the characters and combat, all of that worked so well. So I don't want to crap on the game. I had a good time with it. I think if I had to put a mark on it, it might be high 70s or low 80s from me. And I think that that comes down to the gameplay. The game's framework doesn't quite do justice to all of that wonderful work that I've just talked about in the aesthetic and the combat and the writing of the main story and the characters specifically. But it's a really solid entry in the Final Fantasy series. It's an accomplished game. I think fans that click with it will really click with it. I'm sure that some people out there will think it is a 10 out of 10 classic. Didn't quite get there for me, but they did swing big with this one, and I admire that. And that is Final Fantasy 16. So I hope you enjoyed that review of Final Fantasy 16. A lot of people in the Discord are still playing it. It seems like people are enjoying it. There are mixed opinions. I'm very curious for some of the Discord members who are playing it to get to the end. I think ChipDip might be playing it. I think Real Dave Jackson might be playing it. I'm curious to see what those guys think of it. We do have a rolled credits channel in the Discord where people come and give their final thoughts on a game that they have just finished. This channel is only for rolled credits posts, so it's fun to scroll back through there and see all the games that have been finished by people this year. And we also have a spreadsheet where we enter the games that we've finished, so you can see a running count of how many games you've finished this year. If you would like to come and join that Discord, become a patron. It's at patreon.com/gamingin the wild. You can support this podcast, join the Discord, get bonus episodes, all of that kind of thing. If there were any Final Fantasy posts in the rolled credits, I would read out people's comments, but I did ask on Twitter. I asked for people who have finished the game or midway through the game to give me their thoughts. I got two. I got one from Blinkoom. I know Blinkoom is a wonderful podcast host on Polykill and IndieQuest, two game podcasts that I listen to every week. Blinkoom says, this game has very high highs and very mid-mids, but I sometimes find myself so compelled by the highlights that I am not too bothered about the other stuff. The music is great, the item economy is pointless, and the game is cool. That's a really, really positive way of looking at it. Do go and check out Blinkoom's podcasts. They are really good, IndieQuest and Polykill. I also got a comment from LeBruce, who said he just got to Bahamut around the 50-hour mark, and he thinks that the line that I tweeted out, it would be twice as good if it were half as long, is perfect. But I do know that LeBruce was playing for the Platinum, and I think spent the first 40 hours of that 50 probably doing fetch quests, so I have a lot of sympathy for that. I do believe that they have moved on and have decided not to get the Platinum. Make of that what you will. So thanks to Blinkoom and LeBruce for sending me their comments. I would like to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube as Gaming in the Wild. Let me know what you thought of this game. It would be great to hear from people and to compare opinions. What did you think of the themes? What did you think of the final fantasiness of it all? And if you've gotten this far, a big thank you for listening. I'll be back next week with a new podcast. Not sure what it will be about as yet. Maybe Viewfinder, maybe something else completely. But I do hope you will come back and enjoy the ride with me. Take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.